Is there anything particular that you came across, Pierre, that you wanted to cover? That was, I've got a few things that
I wanted to talk about. I was just telling Doomberg that I'd really like to talk about Winner Takes All, the Michael Saylor. But I really liked the references to Ivan.
Ivan on Tech. Yeah,
Ivan on Tech and
Pumpamentals.
Hugo Stinnes. Yeah, Pumpamentals and respect the pump.
Respect the pump.
Yes,
it's
one of my favorite all-time YouTube clips.
Definitely talk about that, and then climate newspeak. I think the where you led with Charlie Angus, and then got into the digital hate.
Yeah.
Monitor.
They just beat Elon in court, unfortunately.
Yeah. That was another one. And then we could talk about prime time.
Sure.
How about you, Mike?
I think that's going to get us a lot of places. I think it's hard not to talk about a bit of the geopolitical situation because it sets up the discussion on so many of the natural resource plays.
Yeah.
And so
we're publishing on that as soon as this podcast is over. So we're publishing The Energy War Goes Kinetic.
Fantastic. I think that sets the table for a little bit of the natural gas situation, the avoidance of a recession, all the things that we've talked about previously too. Thoughts on gold. Obviously your sound drops on, you can buy a chocolate bar or a million metric tons of natural gas are always awesome. And if we get time, I'd love to talk about, sort of the nuclear energy side, uranium, the emerging markets experience that we're seeing, and then the potential draws on the grid as you move forward with more AI, more cryptocurrencies, more electric cars, what's going to provide the electrons.
Yep.
And, so those types of things I think are all, so there's a lot there. Let's see what we get through and yeah, love it. Love all of it.
All right.
Any particular order, Doomberg, that you think goes? Okay.
I could talk to anything we've written.
Okay, great. I'll let you lead it off, Pierre. You start all the direction that you've got in your head and away we go.
Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com. This is the first new episode of Raise Your Average for 2024. It's great to be back together again. I'm joined by co-host Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management. Mike, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. And we got a heck of a guest to kick off 2024 with.
Definitely.
We've
got a real treat for you today. As you can probably already see, Doomberg is here. Welcome, Doomberg. It's great to have you here and to kick off the new season on the show. This is your second appearance. It's an honor and a privilege to have you.
Pierre, Mike, great to be back. What an honor to be your first guest of the year. It's been quite the start to 2024, and we have no shortage of fascinating and scary things to talk about.
Absolutely. It's been quite a year. And, for those who don't know Doomberg has quickly become one of the most unusual occurrences in the time-space fabric of thought leadership on energy, commodities, finance, and the economy at large. The Doomberg team masterfully connects what appear to be unrelated dots into actionable insight. You can find Doomberg on Substack if you didn't already know. And by the way, they are, by a substantial margin, the most read, most subscribed Substack column today.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
It's been quite a year so far. You've covered some incredibly interesting things. There's a lot of distortion in the market. Things seem to have gotten quite warped. And I thought a good place to start would be Bitcoin. And in particular, you had a great piece recently titled "Winner Takes All," where you drew the parallel between Hugo Stinnes and Michael Saylor and what's been going on at MicroStrategy. And you also tied that together with Ivan on Tech. And I'd love for you to touch on what's been going on there, what's happening behind the scenes with Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy, and what ramifications are for the market.
Yeah, it was a fun piece to write. The real driver for the piece was we had written quite critically about the risks that Michael Saylor was taking with his company's equity back in the day. I think it had been 2 years since we had last written about him. And our main point back then was to make a leverage bet on a volatility of a high volatility asset like Bitcoin seemed rather imprudent from a fiduciary perspective. Having said that, we're not afraid to be wrong. And it's very clear that history is written by the winners. And Michael Saylor has done quite well with that bet. A lot of thought went into that piece. The opening story of that piece is this amazing market action that happened in NVIDIA on March 8th right. of 2024, where we had an intraday swing of $270 billion. And that kind of market move, in our view, there's a deeper meta story in there to unpack, which is this complete and utter disregard for valuation and the willingness on the part of speculators to trade fiat for basically anything. You know, Matt Levine likes to say there's a casino value to it, and so it's understandable from that perspective. But I think there's something deeper going on. And we were reminded of Adam Ferguson's outstanding book, really one of the most unsettling books you could read, called When Money Dies, The Nightmare of the Weimar Hyperinflation. And in that book, he describes in great detail the speculative mania that just preceded the onset of hyperinflation. And as we said in the piece, look, not every episode of speculative mania is a precursor to currency debasements, but nearly all such debasement episodes are indeed marked by them. And this explains our longstanding interest in Bitcoin and crypto. And look, credit where credit is due. Michael Saylor has been fully transparent in all public forums and in his filings. Everything he's doing is 100% legal. We thought it was unwise back in the day, but it looks like his bet has more than paid off. And we synthesized the story with this colorful character, this Swedish entrepreneur, Ivan on Tech. I can't pronounce his last name, so I'll just call him Ivan on Tech. And right. he put out this amazing 50-second video, which has colloquially become known as Respect the Pump. And it's just really, yeah. I respect Michael Saylor's pump, and he's done it.
Always respect the pump, whether it's Arnold or Michael Saylor. It's just, it's dogma yeah. for sure.
I really liked, I like the way you described the manner in which, you know, Michael Saylor has been, you know, raising money through convertibles and then buying up, you know, as much Bitcoin as he can into this rally we've had. And but while he's doing that, of course, you've already mentioned that you know, he's selling some 5,000 shares a day between January 2nd and April 26th, all while, you know, it's you know, you refer to it as taking advantage of the pumpamentals, but you know,
well, that's Ivan's line, not mine, but it's a brilliant phrase, it must be said.
Yeah. What's the can you talk about the parallel that you drew with Hugo Stinnes?
Yeah, so Hugo Stinnes is notorious in the world of economic history for having the wisdom to have called the hyperinflation in Weimar and to have emerged from it as the wealthiest person in Germany. And the way that he did this was quite brilliant and simple. In fact, brilliant in its simplicity. He simply borrowed every dollar the banks would lend him to acquire real assets, i.e. factories, in necessary goods. And that really shows you the role of money and the role of reality in the world. And fiat currencies come and go, but factories that produce food or coal or pick your favorite, you know, heavy industry, those will always be in demand. And Hugo simply borrowed from the bank to buy cash-producing assets, which the banks could justify. And by the way, banks keep lending during hyperinflation. I mean, this whole boiled frog phenomenon as you head into, you know, inflationary spirals is a fascinating cultural thing to observe. So he just kept borrowing money. And with pricing power on the assets that he owned, he was able to pay back the loans with radically debased fiat, effectively got all these these factories for free. In Michael Saylor's case, he believes in the imminent demise of fiat, and history would support that all fiats eventually collapse. And he has made his bet accordingly. And so he will borrow as much as the banks will lend him, buy Bitcoin. By the way, we sort of quoted Nassim Taleb in that piece, trying to create a self-licking lollipop, which is one of my favorite phrases of all time. It's right up there with the pumpamentals. And we should get into what Ivan means when he says pumpamentals, by the way, because there's deep insight into that little phrase. But MicroStrategy and Saylor are trying to create a flywheel effect, basically, where because their stock is trading at a premium to Bitcoin, if you just take the market value of MicroStrategy and divide it by the number of Bitcoin they own, the market is valuing MicroStrategy at 2 times the price of Bitcoin, which makes no sense. And the way to close that arbitrage is to keep selling stock, raising debt, and buying as much Bitcoin as you can. Just a side diversion on pumpamentals, you know, the opening quote to that piece, again, it's just such a brilliant line. I'll read it. The best thing is to have 50% fundamentals, 50% pumpamentals. But the fundamentals are always decades behind the pumpamentals. When you assure that the pumpamentals are good, you can move on to the fundamentals. And that is actually, that captures the phenomenon of low float, short squeezes, you know, the GameStop, AMC, you know, crypto craze. Yeah.
Your earlier, your NVIDIA.
Yeah.
NVIDIA. Although NVIDIA is different. There's something different going on with NVIDIA, and we always respect market moves. Like we're not quick to dismiss what the market is telling us. We just wonder what it might be saying. But the fundamentals is a very interesting thing. And we saw with the ARM IPO, which is probably a more apt analogy, where Masa-san created a short squeeze worthy stock by only floating 10% of the shares. And he had no intent to sell. He's just using that as collateral to get even more debt for his speculative adventures. And again, when you have manias like this, people like Michael Saylor and Masa-san at SoftBank tend to look like geniuses. And people like us, me in particular, who advise caution, tend to look like luddites.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Masa-san, because, you know, if you watched, I mean, you know, it's a little bit fictionalized nonfiction, but if you watch the HBO series on WeWork, you kind of get the sense that Masa-san, you know, there again, was, no matter what the bad news was that was coming out about WeWork, he just kept on pumping more money into it in order to support it, to support, you know, all the claims and to keep the business going until they could actually take it public. And then, of course, we all know what happened there, but was a failure. But
you know, I have a lot of respect for Masa-san. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So I have a fair bit of experience in the venture capital space in my professional life. And Masa had, again, like Michael Saylor, a very well-disclosed strategy, which is I am going to overload startups with a mountain of cash and create local monopolies that are only focused on growth. And once they win in the market, then they'll have pricing power. It's just that simple. And he did that over and over and over again.
Right.
And his investors knew they were signing up for an ultra high beta leverage bet on technology. And if you just look at what happened with Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, all the creditors are getting made whole because of some of the speculative bets that SBF made have paid off handsomely. Well, I saw that the estate, I guess is the best name I could come up with for it, the FTX bankruptcy CEO just sold equity interest in an AI startup for something like $900 million, which is going to go a long way to making all the creditors whole. Like Masa knows what he's doing. Masa is a very intelligent person. Masa takes reckless gambles that you and I and Mike might be hesitant to do with other people's money. But the people who are giving him money want that. This is the part of their portfolio where they expect asymmetric disproportionate returns. And so in the VC world, Masa's strategy was very well known. And he would just select one of five startups in one space and give them so much money that the other four startups had no chance of competing. And he would be willing to buy market share. Now, I happen to think economically integrated across society, that's a pretty poor strategy. But isolated to Masa's mandates, he gives his investors what they're looking for, which is ultra high volatility returns with asymmetric upside.
And what makes you wonder, you know, what would have happened if what would have happened in Sam Bankman-Fried's case with FTX if he had simply beat the clock?
Yeah, so he's the type of person that would always blow up, though.
Yeah.
Because the more he was winning, the more liberties he would take. I would draw a distinction between him and the likes of Masa-san. Masa-san does seem to try to play by the rules. For example, there's never been a hint of misappropriation or anything like that. He's aggressive. He pushes the boundaries. But again, basically everything he does is very well disclosed, whereas SBF was stealing from customers and misappropriating funds and commingling accounts and breaking every rule of fiduciary that you could imagine. And with those types of people, success emboldens narcissism. And so he would have blown up eventually. And we should be thankful that he blew up at the size that he was when he did.
Right, before it was a systemic issue, or a more systemic issue.
We've got a couple of those on the market right now, it must be
said. Yeah, I wonder if we can bring the sort of the train of thinking from the sort of speculative manias, the story of Steins in Germany, and how the current set of monetary and fiscal policy directions may end up in a situation like that and maybe causing some of the speculative mania. Does that a tangent
sure.
that make some sense to try and thread those together?
I mean, I think if you look at the fact that the U.S. is adding $1 trillion in debt every 90 days, one can't help but wonder what this all means and whether looking back 20 years from now, we might be scratching our heads as to how we were such stable boiled frogs ourselves as we participate in this market. And, you know, it the rampant corruption of American politics is disturbing. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. It's a union party system. The upcoming election is, I think, going to tear apart the fabric of American culture. I think half of the country is going to reject the result, no matter who wins. I watched with some interest a pretty interesting campaign video put out by Robert Kennedy Jr., who, were it not for his terrible energy policy, would be quite interesting to me as a sort of center-right, relatively moderate, pro-capitalist, low-taxation, small-government conservative. There's no real good choices for me, you know, in this election. I would love to have seen Kennedy pick Joe Manchin as a running mate, perhaps like a bit of a unity ticket that we could get behind. But that's not going to happen. We have Trump and Biden. And frankly, look, I mean, objectively, one side is trying to put the opposing side in jail, whatever you think of legality of Trump's actions. Just that the headline itself is undeniably bearish for cultural stability.
Yeah.
And so we're heading into a very dangerous period. I look at what's happening in Canada, for example, and really what you have is a lame duck prime minister who's deeply unpopular, whose government is held together by a minority partner who won something like 8 seats outside of British Columbia in the Canadian Parliament. And it's really amazing that we have this situation where, you know, internet hate laws and so on, very controversial anti-free speech agendas are being imposed on Canadians, everyday Canadians, over their objection. I think everybody's just sort of patiently waiting for the next election, assuming all of this will be overturned. But that's a very dangerous thing. You have to fight these things, you know, straddle them or choke them out in the early phases, because once they get put on the books, they're very hard to undo. They become normalized. And so it's a dangerous time in the West, especially as things look to blow apart here in Russia, Ukraine. So lots of ways we can go on this, but it's the doomsday clock is closer to midnight than it's ever been in our view.
Right. Well, let's dig into the geopolitical implications. A lot of this is global too. The sort of the number of elections that are occurring this year, the populism across the globe, the you know, sort of the signs of the fourth turning. You know, very, very, as you say, dangerous time. So let's dig into the geopolitical situation, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, some of the updates that are occurring there, and your thoughts on trickling through the rest of the world and energy policy and things like that.
Yeah, we're about to press send on a piece right after I'm done recording with you guys called The Energy War Goes Kinetic. And we start that piece by quoting Lindsey Graham, who says, "We must be clear in our message to Hamas and Iran. If you escalate this conflict any further, we will come after your oil refineries and destroy your industry." And that, what a dangerously reckless thing to say. And as we say in the piece, you know, from Graham's perch in Washington, nobody shoots back. You know, risks are only borne by adversaries, and consequences don't rebound, and proxies never go rogue, and bluster and threats are strong, and prudence and caution are weak. And that type of self-fulfilling, threats are, they land different than we might hear them in the West. Oh, that's just Lindsey Graham, neocon, warmonger. You know, if you're in Russia, coming off of this terrible massacre of civilians at the theater in Moscow, those types of words probably land a little differently. And we open the piece talking about the Nord Stream pipeline and what a dangerous precedent that was to destroy it. And one of my favorite lines that I've written in a while is, "With the sincerity of effort reminiscent of O.J. Simpson's search for the real killer, intelligence communities in the West can't quite seem to put their finger on who might have been responsible." It's becoming very clear what actually happened here.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the debate in Congress to basically declare war on Russia. Russia, we have this techno-arrogance in the West, personified by Peter Zeihan, whose work I respect and I enjoy and I find entertaining. We just assume that we're superior in every way that matters to everyone else in the world. And I, having traveled the world and interacted in the international economy at a major commodity company, Russia is a formidable power. Like, Russia knows how to reorient its economy and carpet bomb its way from east to west. They've done this before. Like, they know what they're doing, and we're losing this war. And the main point of this piece is, as the inevitable outcome approaches, Ukraine is understandably getting very desperate and bitter. You know, suddenly it's politically inexpedient to support them, and Biden is very focused on the election. And so we have this deadlocked standoff in Congress where, you know, Trump would like to see Ukraine lose and use it as a political weapon. I mean, I'm being very generalized. Of course, it's much more nuanced than that. But if you're Ukraine, it's like, hey, we got into this war with your backing, and now you're hanging us out on this branch. I'm going to go ahead and, you know, I'm going to attack Russian oil refineries over the protest of the Biden administration. Game theory would suggest, with nothing left to lose, the Ukrainians are only going to get more desperate. And it's a very scary time. And I think this event in Moscow on Friday was a watershed moment. I must say that I purchased some calls in the VIX index based on the fact that this seemed like a 9/11 type event for Russia, except they have nuclear weapons and seem to be willing to use them. We're at a very, very dangerous time. And geopolitically, the next few weeks, I think, are going to be rather frightening.
Yeah, we're on the precipice of a lot of different actions that can be taken in very stressful times.
Yeah, and you very aptly pointed out, Doomberg, that the sanctions against Russia are having the exact opposite effect in terms of the country's wealth.
Yeah, I mean, again, anybody who's spent 5 minutes in industry knows that you make all your money on price, not volume. And that you can't reduce somebody's revenue, somebody as important as Russia, somebody who has such a large share of the export volumes, which is different than the total volumes, but prices are set at the margins. Russia, as one of the largest exporters of energy in the world, is highly sensitive to the price of energy, not so much the volume it is able to put on the market. And we said from the very beginning, when it was not very popular to say so, that our sanctions policy was idiotic. Just imagine we were successful. Imagine we take half of Russia's BTUs off the market. The price of oil is going to more than double, and he's going to make it up, you know, with price. And the analogy that we would use is, if we're a major refiner in the U.S., let's say, and we own 8 large refineries, and the industry is running at 95% capacity and it's super tight, and one of our 8 refineries blows up, we're going to make more money. Because that happened. The prices of refined goods are going to go up more than 12.5%. And we're going to see windfall profits. And in fact, it is not uncommon during such tightness, for energy companies to be accused of aggressively running maintenance schedules in order to take volume offline artificially and put a bid under the price. And by trying to attack Russia's volume, it was always doomed to rebound. And it has. It's, again, one of our best calls that we were most right on most early and that we are most unhappy with having made. It's just so clearly a failure from the beginning. And to see the same people now directing the military strategy is I don't know, it's not good.
Well, I think the fall of the Berlin Wall, I think some of that was predicated on the energy policy of the day, keeping oil at $10 a barrel.
Yeah, we outproduce them.
Yeah, and just making it very unprofitable or marginally profitable to pump the oil they had and to reduce the potential money's in the coffer to create issues globally.
It's amazing. You know, we can watch how a couple of million barrels of excess oil that nobody can store drives the price of oil to negative $37 a barrel. And we could watch how the outbreak of a conflict risks, you know, global energy flows to the point where oil spikes to $130 a barrel. That all happened in 18 months. So what does that teach you? It teaches you that the inelasticity of oil is exceptional. Joe Biden cut the price of oil in half by releasing 1% of global supply for 6 months from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. What are we doing? Russia is a major exporter of oil. If we blew up all of Iran's refineries, as Lindsey Graham so flippantly says that we should, how are we going to handle $250 oil? Right? That's what would happen. You know, I remember watching with my jaw down this 60 Minutes profile of the architect of the U.S. sanctions policy and how proud he was, proud as a peacock, really.
Yeah.
And the piece was called The Peter Principle, I believe. I don't have it in front of me, but I was just amazed. This guy has absolutely no idea what he's talking about. He is in the halls of power. There's clearly nobody from industry advising him. And he's advising the president, and the president is listening. It's true. What does Justin Trudeau know about energy? I shouldn't be surprised because I'll tell you guys a story. Even in industry, of course, you know, the people at the top sometimes are vastly uneducated, surprisingly so. And I remember the very first time I got to go to a board meeting at a major Fortune 100 company. Young up-and-coming executive, I get to make a pitch on an important project and give the technology basis for why we're cutting this billion-dollar check. And I remember thinking, okay, I'm finally going to get into the inner oracle. This is where all the brains are. This is where all of the mysteries of our policy that I don't understand, there's going to be some revelation where it'll all make sense, the great aha moment. These people were scarily mediocre. And there is no inner oracle even in the cutthroat competitive world of corporate America, where some secret, siphon can be found to explain all of the behavior that from the front lines looks rather bizarre. It's the same thing with politics. Justin Trudeau is who he seems to be. He has a pedestrian intellect who was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. And and he's in charge of Canadian energy policy. It's remarkable.
It's scary. Now, go ahead, Pierre.
Yeah, I was just gonna just to tie it together with your recent piece, Climate Newspeak. You highlighted how Charlie Angus, a prominent NDP backbencher in Trudeau's minority government, took to the floor recently with a private members' bill, C-372, which proposes to fine. Up to half a million, proposes a fine of up to $500,000 for anyone found to be promoting a fossil fuel and up to $1 million for companies doing so. I mean, this to read that was actually quite shocking. That was not something that got a lot of airtime in the news.
Yeah,
but,
I think
You also aptly pointed out, go ahead. Sorry,
no,
I'm
please,
not going to answer.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
You aptly pointed out the opposite, which was, are they going to start imposing? Is there going to be fines for those who try to detract against wind and solar power, you know, renewables.
Yeah, that's coming. So
yeah,
it would be easy to dismiss the Angus affair, you know, if he were just another wingnut politician pushing forward, you know, some crazy concept that nobody supports. But neither of those things is true.
He's like, important.
Yeah, he's like we're probably unique amongst the American bloggers for our knowledge of Canada for a variety of reasons. And we follow Canadian politics quite closely. And Canada, much like California and Germany, tend to be early markers for the insanity that will eventually come to the U.S., which is one of the many reasons why we follow Canadian politics. But look, I mean, Angus is a relatively distinguished career politician. He was runner-up for the national NDP leadership position in 2017. And I think that we in Western society have become far too flippant about bending the awesome powers of both government and social media platforms to suppress speech that current leadership doesn't like. And the thing that amazes me is these people never ponder the precedents that they're setting ever rebounding on them. Like Donald Trump might win the presidency. Right. You know, Pierre is probably going to be the next prime minister, right? Like if we set these precedents and we normalize them, your political opponents will find it very difficult to resist the temptation to use them against you. And we would be the first to write critically about Trump if he were to do so, if he becomes president in the U.S. We sort of came of age during a time where most Western leaders happen to be on the liberal side of the ledger. But if things were happening in this regard and conservatives were doing it, if Brian Mulroney was doing this, we would be writing just as critically about it. This is principles beyond partisanship. These are ideological stances one must take or risk losing the freedoms that we cherish that are the foundation of our economic prosperity. And we're in a very, again, don't want to be too doom and gloom because, as you say, the thing that comes after the fourth turning is the rebirth, which I'm anxiously looking forward to. You know, can't get there fast enough, but the friction of the transition is going to be quite challenging. But there's no doubt that saying good things about fossil fuels, the bridge from there to outlying criticism of wind and solar is a very short one, and it's coming. And as we outlined in that piece, criticizing quote-unquote solutions to quote-unquote climate change, a lot of quotes needed, is becoming labeled in the U.S. and around the world as hate speech. Like, when did physics become hate speech? And this is
coming. A very fine line. Yeah.
This is happening, you know. And again, we labeled Angus as a do-gooder in our piece of the captions. We try to be a little subtle and sometimes humorous with them, but there is no more dangerous thing than a do-gooder with power.
Absolutely.
Ain't that the truth?
They are, I mean, they're treating fossil fuels as though they're tobacco.
Well, here's the thing. The word that is missing from all of this is trade-off. So yeah. In their worldview, fossil fuels, we derive no benefit from fossil fuels. So any benefits of the burning of fossil fuels are going to be made illegal if Angus had his way. Just the mere description of the benefits of fossil fuels would be a fine punishable up to $500,000, as you articulated. Only bad things come from fossil fuels. Wind and solar have no negative consequences and are universally hailed as green. This is the stuff of religion. I mean, this is not the stuff of science and politics and economics. And until we can have adult conversations about trade-offs, which, by the way, all roads would then lead to nuclear, we're going to be stuck in this partisan war where team sports dominates and the broader good of society is pushed to the side. I mean, where are the politicians who begin with the fundamental question of what is right by my constituents and how can I work with my ideological opponents to find the right set of compromises that raises the standard of living of most people? Instead, we have this food fight in the cafeteria. And the 24-hour headline wars and the giant game of gotcha and personal destruction where competency is driven out of the system and you're left with the still bottoms of intellectualism, which is basically the tar residue at the bottom of the still pan that nobody can make much use for. And that's what Justin Trudeau is. That's what Joe Biden is. I'm sorry. That's what Boris Johnson is. These people are not the best and brightest. The best and brightest are out in private industry making money.
Yeah. It's a real Ayn Rand situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's and with Canada being such a large producer of natural gas, oil as well, but I mean largely a natural gas oriented hydrocarbon economy. And maybe we can shift gears a little bit into the situation in natural gas and the proliferation of 2.5 Saudi Arabias discovered in North America, as you like to say, and talk about how that has been actually a boon in preventing, you know, potential recession in the U.S. and a resurgence in the manufacturing sector and the industrial sector.
Yes. Before I do that, I want to follow up on something you mentioned about Canada and natural resources. Canada, by all measures, on a per capita basis, should be the richest country in the world. Canada has enormous hydrocarbon wealth, an unbelievable inventory of hydropower, clean, carbon-free, cheap energy across Quebec and Ontario. The best nuclear reactor technology in the world, I think, CANDU circumvents the need for enrichment, for example. Utterly safe, clean, cheap, reliable supply chain. Canada has food and forestry and amazing river systems and natural resources and a relatively intelligent immigration policy. And, you know, Canada has outstanding universities and real strong culture of social cohesion, which still remains. There's some issues, of course, Alberta separatism, Quebec separatism, the poverty in the Atlantic provinces and so on. But I mean, the resource potential of Canada under the right leadership is truly amazing. And so is the U.S. So let's talk about natural gas.
Yeah.
Today, natural gas is trading for, you know, less than a medium Diet Coke at McDonald's for a million BTUs. And on an oil equivalent price, natural gas is trading for $10 a barrel of oil. And, you know, I was looking through the history of the Marcellus Shale development and some of the skeptical predictions about it in the late 2000s by certain set of people who have been very loud in their opposition to our view that peat cheap oil is a myth. And they were saying that the Marcellus Shale would never get developed and shale would never be economic. And the Marcellus Shale is two Qatars today. It is the single most prolific natural gas development in the history of humankind. And the U.S. produces something like 28% of all of the world's natural gas, and most of it is trapped here. And unlike most petro states, because that's what the U.S. is today, it has a very sophisticated downstream manufacturing sector that can take advantage of this miracle of abundance of cheap hydrocarbons, and it is doing so. And you know, we wrote a piece called Slick Landing, where we explained, in our view, why we won't be seeing a recession before the upcoming election, much to the chagrin of many of our conservative readers who are kind of secretly hoping for economic turmoil so that their guy could get into office. And I understand that view, but you have to play the pieces on the board. You're not going to have a recession when we are swimming in hydrocarbons. I mean, the Permian Basin is the most prolific oil, NGL and gas producing region in the world. We've added 2.5 Saudi Arabias, as you mentioned, because of the shale revolution. And when you plug 2.5 Saudi Arabias into, you know, manufacturing and data centers like we have here in the U.S., we're a leading technology country. We have sophisticated venture capital markets. We have amazing universities. We have, you know, despite the rot of corruption in Washington, D.C., the U.S. is still an economic power. Much of this is because of the uniqueness of mineral rights and land ownership and the fact that energy development can be mostly regulated at the state level, thank God, because then places like Oklahoma, Texas, and North Dakota and Tennessee get to chart their own path. And states like California can impale themselves on the altar of climate change. And you know, they are free to do so. But, you know, Texas is vastly more important to the world than Saudi Arabia, for example. And we also wrote a piece about how Mexico is sort of a hidden beneficiary of all this because of the land pipelines connecting the Permian Basin directly into all of these new natural gas power plants that Mexico is building. And they have this huge advantage of being able to export into the NAFTA trade region. And so you're seeing this wave of manufacturing being. Imagine if Mexico got its government together. Imagine if it you know, put the cartels down and managed to get some semblance of order, what an economic boom they would be experiencing today over and above their existing numbers. And this explains the strength of the peso. One of the things that I find interesting in macroeconomics is we can all say if oil goes to 150, we're going to see a recession. We can all say Germany has screwed up its energy policy, so it's deindustrializing. But we can't say America is swimming in cheap hydrocarbons and that explains relative GDP strength. Like it's two sides of the same coin, guys. Yeah. Like if you have $1.60 natural gas and a vast chemical industry slurping it up with a straw, who get to compete, you know, internationally, fertilizer, chemicals, paints, coatings, cement, you name it. Like these people are drowning in cheap hydrocarbons. And then there's an investment boom in the manufacturing sector. We saw it in manufacturing construction, and we're going to soon see it in manufacturing jobs as the inevitable, you know, the snake consumes the rat and it works its way down the snake's body. And I don't think we're in for a recession until November. And there's lots of, you know, humming and hawing about this and, oh, it's unsustainable. Well, of course, fiscal stimuli aren't usually the catalyst for recessions until they blow everything up, and the Fed's not going to let everything blow up ahead of the election. And so when you have fiscal surplus, i.e. stimulus, you have cheap hydrocarbons, and you have an accommodative Fed, these are not the ingredients from which recession cakes are baked.
Yeah. You know, I listened to the State of the Union speech this year with Biden, and he just reminded me of, you know, the immigration issue that he brought up during the State of the Union speech, which was that, you know, how the White House was is spearheading legislation that would speed up the amount of time it takes to deport illegals from the U.S. back to Mexico or back to Latin America. And he said that, you know, by canceling the promise that it would take 6 to 8 years to deport somebody down to 6 months, speed it up to 6 months, less people would be likely to spend $8,000 to pay a coyote to get them across the U.S. border, because the likelihood that they could stay in the U.S. for any amount of time, you know, beyond 6 months would dramatically be reduced. But I think when you couple that with the industrial boom that's happening in, and just to refer back to your Mexico comment and your piece on Mexico, there's this industrial boom happening in Monterrey in northern Mexico, which would be a direct recipient of all that cheap natural gas to power those factories. Right. I mean, recently Tesla has recently announced building a plant there, and then you've got a lot of the major auto companies building vehicles. But if you feel an economic boom with cheap natural gas in Mexico, then you're creating an opportunity for Mexicans who would or Latin Americans who would have wanted to come to the U.S. to stay in Mexico. So rather than building a wall.
Yeah.
Rather than building
build a reason to stay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you know, on one hand you've got Biden's disincenting, you know, the illegal crossing by shortening the amount of time you could possibly remain in the US, and at the same time simultaneously you've got this industrial boom happening in northern Mexico, which could also provide the impetus to stay. So very interesting what's going on there. It seems very productive, very, you know, like something which definitely speaks to your thesis on natural gas, cheap natural gas preventing a recession.
Yeah, I should say, as a person who has stood online in innumerable, you know, border control crossings, either via car into and out of Canada and from all of my travels overseas, I don't know how it became controversial that we should have secure borders. Like, why am I standing in line when I fly back from Europe then for you to check my papers if we're just going to have a free-for-all at the border? I don't really understand how this became a partisan issue.
Right.
And, you know, the government knows who I am. Like, they know I'm not going to blow up a plane. They know what color socks I wear on Wednesday. Why do I have to take my shoes off when I go to JFK? right? Like, they know who I am. They know I'm not going to board. I'm not going to blow up a plane. Like, I'm a law-abiding member with a family that I love dearly and with a good prospects in a career that I love doing. Like, what are we doing? If we're going to go through all of this theater, security theater, post 9/11, you know, et cetera, then, like, I don't know how this became controversial. Now, of course, nothing would be better for the stability at the border than for Mexico to develop from a developing country to a developed one. And we should be working as hard as we can with our partners in Mexico to make that happen for a variety of reasons, not the least of which that would make North America the most powerful region in the world. We already have all the ingredients we need. And so I, you know, lots of things about modern politics befuddle me. I would say that the border security issue, I mean, again, how many times have you crossed the border and had a border guard be rude to you? Right. Happens all the time. Well, like, they could see what car I'm driving. They could see my children in the car. They have everything about me in the database, much more than you would be comfortable with them perhaps knowing about you. Like, what are we doing here? Why the inconsistency? This is something I don't really understand.
It can be the state's seeking of all of that information to have and hold. And there's there's been some other tax reform in Canada, you know, Bear Trust having to now file significant tax forms. So if you're a joint account owner on a bank account, you need to file significantly more tax paperwork in Canada. This is a new policy that's been laid out, and it's just said, it's only for information purposes. We're trying to stop anti-money laundering. Like, you're trying to stop anti-money laundering on joint bank accounts with mom and pop. Anyway, I digress. I wanted to share one thing that was interesting about the million BTUs of energy, just so people can put that in context. You know, with the change in your pocket, it's 10 days of electricity for the average American home. It's, you know, more than 200 miles that you can drive in your car. So just to put it in context of how much of a subsidy that is, like, you're doing these things with a change in your pocket, just to make it real for people, because a million BTUs can sound like a lot of stuff.
So, yeah, I'll give you real. Like, there's 5.6 million BTUs, I think, in a barrel of WTI oil.
Right.
So if you just multiply $1.60 by 5.6, you're buying $10 oil. By the way, $10 oil in a period of relatively high inflation. So if you look at the inflation adjusted price of natural gas, it's 50 cents, right? Using the Bloomberg inflation index, 50 cents a million BTU is $3 a barrel oil on an inflation adjusted basis. Put it this way, the ratio of the price of oil divided by the price of natural gas should be 5.6. And it's 50 today.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, is that where you build in some of the premium that you calculate as the current price of oil today, given the geopolitical uncertainty? Is that where you're drawing some of that inference from? Or
yeah,
how do you think through that?
Except there's a feedback loop there that is bearish for natural gas, which is with oil at 80, you know, Brent at 85, you have no reason to slow production in the Permian, where you have this amazing amount of associated natural gas that they're paying people to take. In fact, spot price of natural gas in the Permian, I believe, is negative today. I'll pull that up as we're talking. But ironically, the tensions between Russia and Ukraine are deeply bearish for North American natural gas because it's trapped here. And so... And so I'm just pulling up the Waha Hub today. Yeah, spot price minus 72 cents per million BTU. They're literally paying people to take natural gas out of the Permian.
Yeah. Is it trapped by design? Is it?
No.
The pipelines to various places where you can get it to a port and liquefy it and take it offshore seem to be always run into, you know, challenges. And I'm just wondering if that's by design or is that just... a coincidence.
It's in this particular instance a coincidence because Texas is quite an amenable place for such infrastructure pipeline investment. There's ample room to move that to Mexico today. They don't have the capacity to use it. They're building natural gas power plants, you know, as fast as they can. And one doesn't want to overbuild either and become so dependent on something like natural gas because the cycle will turn, right? I mean, production will be curtailed. We're all old enough to know that the cure for low prices is low prices. And so it's an interesting dilemma. But the real situation is the unbridled growth of oil production in the Permian. And as the wells become sort of from first tier to second tier, one of the criteria used to grade the tiers of the wells is the proportion of associated gas that you have with it. So the Permian is becoming more gassy as it produces ever more oil. And so this premium, I would guess that the security premium in oil today is probably $40. If it weren't for the war in the Middle East and the tensions with Russia, I think we would see $40 WTI, $45 Brent in that range. That's what feels like the equilibrium price when we normalize natural gas, coal, you know, LNG natural gas, coal in Newcastle and oil across dollars per million BTU. Oil stands out, and that can only be a risk premium. And so, you know, because of that premium, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where the only real source of growth in the world is the Permian and now Guyana, which is a sort of a more traditional oil play that Exxon is spearheading. And so you just have this, they're producing more natural gas than planners and pipeline constructors could have imagined. And so they just have an enormous amount of it. And by the way, with the push to eliminate flaring, you're only going to see incrementally more natural gas being forced out of the fields onto the market. And pipelines are full. There's relief ahead. You know, capitalism works. The value of producing natural gas in the Permian far exceeds the price of natural gas because it basically is the gating factor for the production of oil. And at $80 oil, they're going to keep doing it.
Amazing.
Interesting. You can infer, I mean, from what you just said, Doomberg, you can infer that the price of natural gas should indeed be higher. You can either the price of natural gas needs to be higher or the price of oil needs to be lower. But I think you just made the point that the price of oil should actually be lower without the risk premium.
Well, arbitrages tend to close downward in a glut. Let's be clear.
Right.
And we have a glut of energy right now. This is something we called back in November, a piece called Liquefied Natural Glut. The thing that needs to happen, which we're beginning to see, is we need to change the engines. Right. Natural gas today is used in industry. There's only so much of that we have, and there's only so quick we can respond to that. It's used to heat homes, and we've had unusually mild winters, last two winters. The storage in the U.S. right now, as of the last report, is something like 42% higher than the five-year average for this time of year. It's stunning. Natural gas is an extraordinarily useful fuel. It's very clean burning. You could burn it in your kitchen and not have to worry too much about ventilation. Nobody would say you should bring your barbecue indoors as you burn coal, right? But we don't have the engines. Like, we could run our cars on compressed natural gas. We could certainly run long-haul trucking and replace diesel. We're beginning to see mining companies and so on switch to Cummins engines that run on CNG. This is going to happen, but over time, in the long run, everything will be oil and will sell for the same energy-adjusted price. But the long run is measured in decades. But if you're an analyst and you're an investor, or you're an investor in startups, and somebody pitches you an innovative way to use cheap natural gas, you want to go along that because there's going to be plenty of it.
Have you guys looked at the Tonga eruption, the potential for that to create warming over the 5 years? And do you think that is potentially some of the cause of the last couple of, I guess it was in January 2023, but any thoughts?
Yeah.
There?
So, I mean, we've looked at the broader question of climate change and carbon emissions. You know, there's this new movie that came out this week that is causing quite the stir. I'm not sure if you've seen it, called Climate the Movie, which is basically the pro-climate change movement would characterize it as the climate deniers' best shot at disproving the connection between burning of fossil fuels and the changing of the climate. We've not gone down that road, but mostly because it's not our domain expertise, and it's such a polarized argument that you're not going to change anybody's minds in that regard. The two broad hypotheses are that the burning of fossil fuels increases CO2, which increases temperatures. And on the other side, the broad hypothesis is the sun drives the temperature on the Earth. And as the Earth gets hotter, more CO2 gets released from the oceans. And so the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere has very little to do with human involvement and everything to do with the sun. I don't have enough expertise to nullify either of those hypotheses. I find it interesting. We've been researching it for a long time and deciding if and how we might write about the subject in a way that doesn't just become noise in the field of hyperpartisan warfare. Oh. Not sure we can do it, but I'm reading it with some interest. But this volcano explosion, you see the full gamut again, like people who are blaming the warm winters of the past 2 years on that explosion, and people who are saying it's a giant nothing burger. And I don't have the expertise to partition the arguments into sensible evaluation. It's just such a polarized field that it becomes something that you just give up on after a while.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, let's. I don't want to miss the opportunity to chat a little bit about so digging down the sanctions that occurred with Russia and the $300 billion odd that, you know, now is contentiously being talked about to potentially fund the war against Russia, and some contemplation about further seizing of Russian assets and the implications of those things. Like, I don't think people are thinking about the second and third order implications of taking actions like that. And I'm wondering if you could elucidate some of that for us, Doomberg, that it's not that easy. Those are pretty significant actions that are beyond the pale. And I wonder if you could, for the listeners and for myself, just kind of run through those second and third order effects that haven't really been contemplated. Mm-hmm.
So we like to say one of the reasons why you don't start wars is you might lose them. and let's be honest, like the track record of the West, even the wars we've won, we ended up losing the peace. Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, a war we lost outright. And now in Ukraine. And this assumption that Russia is a country with a gas station on it, I think was fundamental to the formation of policy in the first place and deeply flawed. And again, having participated in industry, I could tell you, you know, I used to make a market in genius, right? I managed PhDs by the hundreds and hired and developed and promoted many of them. And we had a rule, like we hired from all over the world. So I know what IIT Mumbai means, and I know what ETH Zurich means, and I know what, frankly, Moscow State means. And we used to say that Moscow State was a genius school. And if you had Moscow State on your resume, you were hired. That was just a rule. Like if you did a stint at Moscow State and then made your way to the US and got a PhD at MIT, like, come on in. Like, there's room for you in our boat, because we know what it means to get into Fudan in Shanghai. I've lectured there. Like, you go to these campuses and you see armies of brilliant, ambitious, hungry, hardworking young people. That really blows your mind. There's an entire university in China dedicated to petroleum engineering. And last I checked, they had 15,000 students enrolled. The entirety of the US produced 600 petroleum engineers last year. Like, we have this arrogance that Russia, China, and India can't keep Russia's energy going because of a lack of technology. These people have no idea what they're talking about. None, like less than none. It's dangerously naive. Like, Russia has a purpose-driven military-industrial complex, and the U.S. has a profit-driven one. And by the way, where have we outsourced most of the hard parts? To China. Like, what are we doing? And so, is it surprising to me that Russia is outproducing the West in basic weaponry, sophisticated weaponry, hypersonic missiles? No. Like, these are very, very capable countries. And so when we talk about, to your question, seizing $300 billion of Russian property, that implies that we have the ability to do so without consequence. As I said earlier, like, nothing ever rebounds, right? Threats and bluster are strong, and prudence and caution are weak. Russia has countermeasures it can make. We're seeing them right now with this attack, you know, on Friday in Moscow. Very underreported story. We're publishing in our piece today. The largest natural gas storage facility in Europe, which happens to be in Western Ukraine, was attacked by long-range missiles by Russia on Sunday. That facility can store four times as much as the largest facility for such purposes in Germany. Like, we are heading into a very, very dangerous time. And if we just flippantly take $300 billion of a member of the United Nations Security Council, by the way, a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. Like, this is not Iran, which itself is a very powerful country that we shouldn't be so flippantly trying to provoke. This is Russia. Russia has the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons in the world. It has the largest standing army in the world right now, as it's spooled up for the Ukraine situation. It's outproducing the NATO countries by a wide margin across all dimensions that matter. And we're pretending like we're still the one with all the power at the table. This is not defeatism talk. This is realism talk. And you know, we could use a dose of realism here and a bit of humility if we're being transparent.
Agreed.
Absolutely.
And then how does that... So you've got this sort of this confiscation of assets. You have sort of almost like a selective default too, with the SWIFT system and things like that going on to select nations. And now you're seeing this impetus for the movement of gold across, you know, sort of London to China.
Yeah.
And maybe walk us down that path.
So I have a chart that I watch every day, which is the Shanghai gold premium in dollars per ounce on one axis. And on the other axis, I have the price of gold. And in my view, this is the most important chart that people who are interested in gold should be watching. And it's because when you have a premium, so for example, in late September, as gold was bottoming, people were paying $100 an ounce more for gold, physical gold in Shanghai, than the paper price of gold was indicating it should be worth. And what happened? Gold bottomed and went on this amazing run that we've had. So in our view, there's a very crude fight going on right now, which is the desire to keep the paper price of gold low in the West for obvious reasons, because gold is a proxy for inflation and confidence in the fiat system. And central planners and central bankers would like to keep the price of gold relatively low. This is a bit of a conspiracy theory, of course, so one has to be careful. But many in the gold community believe that this is what's going on. And then you have the desire for China to stockpile gold within its borders, anticipating the demise of the U.S. dollar and a world in which the neutral reserve asset becomes gold again and imbalances in international trade are settled by topping up the difference that you can't do with trade with gold, physical gold. And so you see this premium widening, gold price rises. It's moderated a bit now and gold is consolidating around 2180. Happy to send you guys the chart offline, but it's the first thing I look at in the gold market. And, you know, in a world where we abuse our position of simultaneously holding the neutral reserve asset, i.e. treasuries, and the reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, the world will eventually shift away to a different system. And the one thing that most people trust over time is gold, a physical gold. And there's only so much gold in the vaults in the West. And when you have, like today, the premium is $30, that's still pretty wide arbitrage. You can go long and stand for delivery in London, short in Shanghai, and deliver physical and capture the arbitrage. And that's what's happening. We're seeing gold going into China at historic paces. And in a world where we decide we're going to have, you know, a Bretton Woods 4 or 5 or whatever it'll be by then, China's going to be in a strong position because it has drained. You know, if you just plot the total amount of gold in the Western ETFs, despite the price going up, the total amount of gold in these ETFs is going down. Where's that gold going? It's going to China.
And the price is staying strong.
Right. Normally it would be the opposite, right? Yeah. Money flowing in, and you see, like, look, the flow of Bitcoin into these ETFs is positive. The flow of gold the flow of money into these Bitcoin ETFs is positive, and then the Bitcoin held by these ETFs grows. The GLDs and the Sprott Physical Trust of the world, like, when you add up all of the gold held by these entities, it's just a steady drumbeat down while the price of gold is appreciating. That's interesting to me. Where's that gold going? Yeah. It's going to China because of this premium.
Well, and it's an undertold story, right? Not many people are talking about this.
Yeah.
And you have what Doomberg has laid out as the underpinning pumpamentals.
Well, you know what? It makes me think of, if you know the quote, you know, if you don't know who the patsy is.
Yeah. Who's the sucker at the poker table here?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's kind of scary, actually. It's very scary.
I should say I own a lot of gold. I don't think my views on the gold market affect the price, but I should disclose that I personally and other members of the Doomberg team are long physical gold, and we're also long Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, and I think it's always important to put those disclosures out there. But you know, it's a reason why I own a lot of gold. I'm not advocating that people should, but I watched this gold premium in Shanghai, and I see like that's like, you know, $10, a bid ask spread on physical worldwide of $10 to $20 was considered huge, right? And here we had it blowing out to over $100 in late September, early October, just as gold was making a bottom. So it's a fascinating chart to watch.
And I think it's also, sadly, it's an interesting chart to watch due to the fact that, you know, the old quip that if you don't own gold, you either don't understand history or economics. And it's not an asset that it does particularly well because everything is awesome.
Yeah. So we have a three-part strategy for our financial, personal finances. We earn money in fiat because we live in a fiat world. We save by buying real assets like gold, land, and collectibles. And we invest privately where we could impact the outcome. That's the three pillars of our personal financial stool, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so in that context, gold is a savings vehicle, a diversified savings vehicle next to land and artwork or, you know, fine watches or cars, you know, collectible cars, whatever you would like, whatever fancies you, where you can have enough interest in the subject to gain some alpha, knowing what to buy and when and what's a good price and what's not. So I'm a big landowner. I buy locally where I understand where cities are growing. And, you know, boy, that 20-acre plot of farmland just north of town is probably a good one to buy because this is the direction that the city is going. And that's fine. I mean, but that's not a speculation for me. That's saving. So in my view, much like to go back to Hugo at the beginning of this interview, I view the acres that I own and the ounces that I own as the floor of my net worth that will come out of any potential hyperinflationary or dollar collapse scenario, which I don't want to happen. And luckily, we have a business, Doomberg, where we can reprice our subscriptions in a post-hyperinflationary world. And it seems to be relatively inflation robust. And we have... you know, our skills and network as the foundation from which we would rebuild. But, you know, gold is not a vehicle for speculation. Gold is a vehicle for wealth preservation. I'll leave you with one final quip. 20 American Gold Eagles will buy you a mid-sized SUV today. And I would say that in 25 years, 20 American Gold Eagles will still buy you a mid-sized SUV. And that is the prism through which I view gold. I'm not trading gold. Yeah. I don't want to wake up and see gold at $5,000 an ounce tomorrow. Because first of all, gold is in single-digit percent of my net worth, and the social consequences of that type of price movement would be profound. I'm a patriotic American. I would like for the country to get on track to better balance its fiscal situation, to take care of our social safety net a little better than we do, to have a little more politeness in our political discourse. I don't want to see societal collapse. I don't want to see us seizing $300 billion of a permanent member of the UN Security Council's property. I don't want to see war. It disgusts me to no end to watch some of the footage of what's going on in Ukraine and the carpet bombing of these villages. And all these people are innocents. The soldiers on both sides have nothing to do with any of this. It's what a failure, a total failure of the current political class that we're in this situation.
Yeah. Yep. And hopefully we can learn from it and things get better, as you say. Reemergence occurs. Let's hope so. Yeah. Anything else you guys wanted to cover? Anything else that you had on your list, Pierre? I know we're tracking an hour now, so.
I thought maybe we should talk about, I'd like to talk about Primetime, about your piece titled Primetime, which is about which delves into the topic of, introduces the subject of Amazon buying Talon Energy's data center, which is parked adjacent to the nuclear plant that Talon, one of the nuclear plants that Talon Energy runs, and that this data center that Amazon has recently, so it was aptly titled Primetime, this data center will be powered directly by a nuclear plant. And can you touch on that?
Yeah, look, let's end on a high note, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have written for some time that we believe that one of the ways you can model the world, we like to sort of create meta models of the world. One of the ways that you can model the world is to assume that the economies will organize themselves in whatever manner they need to in order to stay on the Kurzweilian exponential growth of computing power curve. And by hook or by crook, that is sort of a foundational axiom. And when you deviate from that mean, the economies will reorganize themselves. The human endeavor is many things, and one of them is a giant computing machine. And Kurzweil's book, The Singularity Is Near, for those that aren't familiar with the reference, is the kind of book that you read as an up-and-coming executive, and you put down and say, whoa, after you read the first chapter. Like, it, for all of the criticisms of Kurzweil, that book was a profound one and made you think, which is really the greatest compliment you could give any book. And this AI revolution, we believe, the U.S. dominates, by the way, these technologies. Much of, you know, all this talk about China and so on, you know, don't kid yourself. We are the home of a vast amount of technology and data centers and so on that needs to be powered, and it will be powered. So our axiom is we will do what we need to do to power these data centers. The political strength of the Amazons and the Facebooks and the Microsofts and the Googles will squash whatever residue of Malthusian opposition exists to nuclear power. And I do think that you really can't get there from here without nuclear. And so therefore nuclear will happen. And I don't think it's a coincidence that just as the explosive need for energy to power the AI revolution bursts onto the scene, we're seeing this worldwide re-engagement with physics and a renaissance in nuclear energy. Now, there's a lot of work to do. Still a lot of bureaucrats, Malthusian opposition embedded within the regulatory regimes of places like the U.S. This is where I give Justin Trudeau full and complete credit for having done the pivot on nuclear power. I think can do as a foundation for both Canadian prosperity and for significant export. I mean, we're talking billion-dollar technologies that Canada is by far the world leader in. But there's no path to get from here to there without nuclear. And so, good news, nuclear will reemerge onto the field, in our view.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. The I kind of think of it as the e-dollar, the electron dollar, AI, Bitcoin mining or mining of cryptocurrencies, the electrification of the travel grid via, you know, cars and things like that, and potentially transportation of goods down the track. The electron is going to reign pretty supreme.
Look, I mean, your standard of living is literally defined by how much energy you get to harvest. And mm-hmm. all humans everywhere want a higher standard of living. And we're going to get it. And it's going to be through nuclear one way or the other. So that's our positive note, I think, that we could
love it.
Yeah. It's a great way to end our conversation.
You know, I'm actually an optimistic person, guys. It just happens to be that the global headlines are deeply pessimistic at this time.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to work through. That leaves some opportunity for people to think through in their own investment thesis, and appreciate you sharing some of the ways that you've thought through it. And we are a Doom Nation member, so a card carrying member of the Doom Nation.
Yeah, same
love,
here.
love the Doomberg thought leadership, and number one guy on Substack. So really, thanks for taking the time today again, Doomberg. And love it, and look forward to our next chat.
Appreciate it,
you
guys.
You're definitely making us think.
That's a great compliment. That's our objective. So we have a couple of objectives with each piece. One is that that you learn something. One is that you think about a problem slightly differently. And the third, of course, is that you have to have at least one good chuckle. And so if we've been able to accomplish those three things, then we are on brand. I did want to correct something you've said now twice, Mike. We are the number one paid finance Substack in the world. But we're far away from the largest on Substack, and I didn't want to take credit from the larger Substacks out there, but in the finance category,
gotcha.
We are proudly number one, which is amazing and humbling and life altering. And we're certainly grateful to every single one of our subscribers. And if anybody listening wants to sign up, they can head over to Doomberg.com. Now we've bought that domain name, and we're going to be launching under that domain name, still on Substack. But I really appreciated the conversation. Always enjoyed it. Looking forward to the next one.
Honored and delighted to have you. It's just, it's been, I can't wait for the next one. I'm thinking about.
Well, I just want to let him go so he can press send on the new piece.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, go.
I'm just waiting.
By the way, you're looking really great. I was just going to say, how do you maintain such a consistent skin tone And you know what?
You got to take care of your body first, you know. This All right, guys.
All right. Thanks, Doonberg. Thank you very much for your precious time today. It's been love having you. Just absolutely love having you.